That's the J.J. Johnson Quintet with Now's the Time. It's from his 1958 album, J.J. in Person. Of course, J.J. is on trombone, Nat Adderley on cornet, Tommy Flanagan on piano, Wilbur Little on bass, and Albert Heath of the Heath Brothers on drums. This is Lead Stories. I'm Eutrice Lead, and we return to yesterday's discussion on how President Donald Trump is likely to deal with his nemesis, Hillary Clinton, and the family-run Bill, Hillary, and Chelsea Clinton Foundation, which is, as we know, the hub of what charity fraud expert Charles Ortel calls the largest unprosecuted charity fraud in history. We talked yesterday about an assessment of how much money and inurements were gained since the foundation has been operating. It is his view that we're talking in the trillions of dollars. Well, a couple of things that appear not to be linked to this whole question, but they in fact are. We have Donald Trump, of course, asking FBI Director James Comey to stay on. He has agreed to do so in that same capacity as which he served under the Obama administration. The FBI director, as you know, is the same person asked by Trump and others to fully investigate, as by Obama, sorry, and others to fully investigate the missing emails, Hillary Clinton's missing emails, and he did, and he came back and said, well, nothing here except that we found that Mrs. Clinton was extremely careless in the way she handled top secret information on this so-called secret server that she had in the basement. But it didn't stop there. He also was asked by President Obama to look into the possibility that Russia had interfered with the elections in order to favor Trump. So that is an interesting background full of conflicts of interest or endemic conflict of interest when he does come into a prosecution having to do with Hillary Clinton. And, of course, we will not have an easy time dismissing the Russia accusation from Trump if that should occur. But something else also happened yesterday, and that was that the veteran Congressman Charles B. Rangel was convicted of 11 of 13 counts that were brought against him by the Committee on Ethics. They said that they found him guilty because he ran afoul of several rules of Congress, and he shouldn't have done these things. He maintains his innocence. He also said that the conviction was unfair. He was not afforded counsel. He was not afforded his due process rights, that he calls the conviction an unprecedented decision. And basically, we don't know where this goes next, except that they are expected to rule soon on a punishment for these being convicted on these counts. Now, what is significant about Charles Rangel is that, of course, comes out of New York State, New York City in particular, Harlem even more particularly. But he was like one of the big deals, one of the big supporters of Hillary Clinton, both when she ran for the U.S. Senate. Charles Rangel played a major role in clearing the path for Hillary Clinton and blocking any other possible candidate running for U.S. Senate out of New York. And so things kind of come together here. And we will talk about that very shortly. But I wanted to bring this to your attention because we have the same kinds of themes occurring over and over again. One of the charges against Rangel was that he used the letterhead, his letterhead of Congress, to solicit funds in order to fund the a building that was to be named after him, on the related to the campus of City College of New York. And in that building was supposed to be housed his, I guess, his afterlife office, because he's resigning soon after 40 years. This man has been in Congress for 40 years. And it is a sad thing to see him go down this way. He had to give up the chairmanship. This is a very powerful committee of the House Ways and Means Committee, which made him at one point the fourth most powerful member of Congress. And a major driving force behind the Congressional Black Caucus. But an extraordinarily strong ally of Hillary Clinton, going back to the days of not just her husband's tenure as President of the United States, but also going back to her bid, and it was successful, as you know, to be the U.S. Senator of New York. I mean, a whole bunch of people played a major role in clearing the path for this office, which Hillary Clinton just felt she was entitled to. She was not really a resident of the state of New York. She moved to New York in order, in time, to qualify for that requirement that you had to be a resident of the state of New York. So she left Bill in the White House after his shenanigans. And she left about 2 years ahead of him and established her domicile in New York City in order to qualify as a senator for the state of New York. Charles Rangel played a major role in getting support for Hillary Clinton, especially from the African-American community. So this is an interesting development. He will be gone soon. He lost the chairmanship of the House Ways and Means Committee 6 years ago when these charges first were proffered. And now, yesterday, we have conviction on 11 of 13 counts of ethics rules violations. Now, how does this all come together? We were talking yesterday that perhaps the retention of James Comey by President Trump is a signal that come hell or high water, he's moving in the direction of prosecuting Hillary Clinton. And he did say that the focus would be on the Clinton Foundation. He had asked or demanded that it be shut down. We reported yesterday, as you know, that the Associated Clinton Global Initiative is going to be shut down. It filed papers with the state indicating that it will, as of April the 15th, cease operations. But it is only one part of this labyrinth of projects and programs operating under the aegis of the Bill, Hillary, and Chelsea Clinton Foundation. We've been tracking the operations of this foundation since May of last year, and we exposed and discussed in great detail the many, many, many illegalities committed by this foundation, and on several levels. You know, we had no real accounting for the hundreds of millions of dollars that were solicited and obtained from individuals, powerful individuals, and governments all over the world. Their forms were not filed. They are not legally incorporated to do what they now have been doing for several years, claiming that these are philanthropic projects associated with the foundation, but they're not properly or legally constituted, nor do they have permission to do the things that they are taking credit for doing good work all over the world. The Clinton Foundation initially was formed to do one thing, and one thing only, and that was to construct a presidential library and research center. That's it. To be based in Arkansas. Then came all of these mysterious and rather high-flung projects that were not legally formed and nonetheless were allowed to operate for all these years and continue to operate without close inspection. One of the reasons could be, as we surmised, was that the Obama administration was reluctant to move against Hillary Clinton. After all, she was Obama's Secretary of State. And it was in that capacity that she was able, as was Bill, her husband, as a former president of the United States, their stations, their political stations in life, basically allowed them to utilize the strength of their political offices to solicit hundreds and hundreds of millions of dollars and also to not account for them. So we return with Charles Ortel, who has been following this for 2 years now and has been studying the minute details of the numbers of the Clintons, the Clinton Foundation, and how it operated, and tracking the numbers down to see where they lead us. And Charles, thanks again for being with us today.
It's my great pleasure, Yatrice. Thanks for having me on.
Thank you. We will pick up from where we left off yesterday about the mystery that continues to be the Clinton Foundation and the related mysteries of why it is that they got away with this kind of criminality for so many years and continue apparently to get away with it even under this new administration of Donald Trump. Are they likely to succeed in the way that they succeeded under Obama, their good friend, to dodge the question of where did the money come from and where did the money go?
Well, I certainly hope, thanks to your reporting and thanks to the growing attention on this important topic, that this investigation or the many investigations inside and outside the U.S. into the activities around the world of the Clinton Foundation will lead, I hope, to real investigations by authorities that exercise subpoena power and convene grand juries and don't tiptoe around the edges of what I believe is the largest unprosecuted fraud in history. And so what happens in these things, it seems, when you study them, is that fraudsters are actually masters of deceit. They're not, you know, they're not ordinary crooks. They're people who have no sense of right and wrong and may delight in concocting the biggest frauds they can come up with. And they're tough to battle. And what I think they do is they draw you into the fraud. And that's what I think happened here. I think that this began not even innocently. This began, as we talked yesterday, at a time when the Clintons were in escalating difficulties. Back in 97, Bill and Hillary were technically, I think, bankrupt in the sense that their accumulated liabilities, fighting the various investigations, which they like to blame on a right-wing conspiracy, but I would say are more because of their acts. Their bills were spiraling out of control, while at the same time, their ability to raise money for their legal defense trust, the first one they set up, evaporated when it was discovered that a Chinese national or a Chinese American was sourcing money illegally from foreign nationals. So they were in great trouble in 97, and they set this thing up October 23, 1997. They've never accounted for it properly. Initially, it was small beer. They claim somehow magically that in 97 they operated it 2.5 months in the midst of this mess, or two months and a week, midst of all this escalating controversy, without either collecting money or spending money. Later, years later, and I think it's actually, it might even be Hillary personally or Bill personally in one of their books, they mentioned that they seeded the Clinton Foundation with monies left over from the inauguration, the second inauguration festival. In the first one, they had collected more than they spent. They rolled that money into the pool for the second one. But, you know, where's the accounting for that? They're under the law. You're supposed to account for the monies raised for inauguration. If you collected money within, I think it's the first 90 days after the close of the inauguration, you have to produce a record of, you know, how much money you raised, how much money you spent on the inauguration. Well, now you're in 97, April 97. Where's the record of that? There's no accounting in 97 for any money coming in to the Clinton Foundation or any expenses. Clearly, they ran expenses. And so it started with a small misstep in the middle of a much bigger mess. And then, you know, 98, we all remember the drama of the second president ever to be impeached. And I'll grant you that Democrats are already, they've given Donald Trump, I guess, 2 days, or maybe just one day before discussing his impeachment. But we remember the drama in 98. They laughably claim on the records that they only got three inflows of money in 1998, only three. While at the same time, a trustee of the Clinton Foundation, David Pryor, whose name is carefully removed, I think, from the record that's on the Clinton Foundation website, but is available to see elsewhere in state registrations, is simultaneously one of three trustees of the Clinton Foundation while also serving as, I believe, chairman of the second Clinton Defense Trust, in which there's press accounts of him raising thousands of donations for that, while at the same time claiming that they only raised three in the middle of the impeachment drama for the Clinton Presidential Library. And I just don't believe that. Then you go on to 1999. There, I think, in the records, which, you know, they probably regret the fact that they were as detailed as they were, there are very few donations in 99, and they begin, I believe, in June. Don't tell me that they raised no money for the Presidential Foundation after Bill defeated impeachment, which I think was February of 1999. Just don't even try to make that argument, because it's rubbish. So the real game, I think, with this foundation early on was to articulate a cause that allies of the Clintons could get a tax deduction for, in theory, supporting. And, you know, they start this thing October 23, '97. Bill's got some years left in office. They don't even break ground on the foundation until, I think, 2002. What were they doing? You know, why did they need to raise money? You know, why did they center the focus of their fundraising for this foundation in New York after he left office? And where are the records showing that they registered in New York validly? They actually told people here in New York exactly who was responsible for the foundation. Bill claims in this book that he was paid $6.4 million for, reportedly, that it was his foundation, the very beginning. My foundation this, my that. It's always him, doing all this work. But he's not listed as an officer or director of the foundation until late 2009, when he becomes, I believe, chairman of the health piece of it. And then I think it's not until 2013 or thereabouts that he becomes listed as a main board director of the foundation. Well, under New York law, you actually have to disclose, and New York law applies here, you have to disclose who's running this foundation. And they've never done that properly. So, you know, Bill gets out of office. There's a furor over the Mark Rich pardon. He's in search for something to do, you know, which sounds good and maybe even is good. And he starts doing all of these things in the name of the Clinton Foundation with his fellow Ira Magaziner, who had his own brushes with problems of not telling the truth under oath in connection with the healthcare task force. So these two merry men go around the world taking credit in advance for all kinds of projects, but there's no disclosure. This is precisely the type of stuff that experts will tell you you're not allowed to do in the guise of charity. You're not allowed to pretend that you are authorized to engage in charity and then do that. But I guess that's sort of what politics is all about. You know, politics, the politicians during campaign season, they get up and they promise they're going to add an extra day to the extra hour to each day and more sunlight and less darkness and make up all kinds of stuff. And nobody ever holds them accountable. So I suppose if you're, you know, or generally holds you accountable. So if you're Bill Clinton, you've spent your entire life doing that, maybe you believe that you could do it in the guise of charity. And so he did it. And, you know, this is the first time in, I think, modern history that there was a prayer of a family member, of Hillary becoming president. So she was bankable. The Clintons had a bankable history during their 8 years in the White House, of monetizing the White House, allegedly. And, you know, the people around the Clintons understand how to make money out of government. You look at the people on the Clinton Foundation board and in their circle of friends. Terry McAuliffe is legendary for citing the many ways in which he was able to get rich off of both charity and political activity. So they saw in Hillary Clinton a bankable commodity, and they just pumped this thing up. They tried scheme after scheme. They've never been caught. And in contrast, you see the two-faced Attorney General of New York, Eric Schneiderman, who, you know, though I don't believe this is appropriate, you know, disclosed out of his own lips in September, I think, of 2016, that his office was investigating the Trump Foundation. Eric Schneiderman and the team in the New York Attorney General Charities Bureau just don't simply believe they have to enforce the laws against friends. That's what it seems to me, because the record of the Clinton Foundation in New York is so absurd. Our laws are really strict. You're supposed to declare every single office, chapter, branch, affiliate. They say on the form that you have to use extra pages if you need extra pages. And by New York rules, they should have disclosed every single one of all these initiatives and affiliates and joint ventures and all the offices of all the different branches everywhere in the world. They never have done that. And so under New York law, they're a gross violation of New York law. I mean, they're raising lots of money here in New York, where there are many rich people inclined to support the Clintons. And, you know, how do those people really know where their money actually went? The answer is they don't, and they must not care because they're not complaining. The other thing that's really odd about this Clinton Foundation, you know, as bad as the rules are for raising money for just covering your operating costs, there are very strict rules in New York and in other states, countries, about raising money for an endowment and then stealing or diverting money from that endowment. You are not allowed to do that. And you can't have an endowment raised to support anything you decide you want to do. There's just, you're not allowed to do that in a charity. You have to have authorized purposes screened in advance by the IRS. And you also have, in states like New York and even in Arkansas, where generally laws are more lenient, you have to get approved to solicit funds of a size of more than typically $25,000 or so. You have to get the advance approval of whatever authority it is in the state that regulates charitable solicitation. And in those disclosures, you have to explain your purposes, you have to explain your branches, you have to explain any defects in your record, and there are many hidden defects in this Clinton Foundation record. You have to explain all that. And you have to also explain any situations where you're in a joint venture with a for-profit entity. You have to disclose that it's full. The Clinton Foundation has done that since 2007-08 with this education operation, quotes, called Laureate. Bill Clinton and Hillary Clinton together. Bill was paid, I believe, $17.6 million from 2010 to 2015 to serve as honorary chancellor of this Clinton Global Initiative University, which I find no evidence actually exists in legal form. You know, how is this all possible? How could Schneiderman drop a bomb, a nuclear bomb, in the middle of a campaign against Donald Trump? Now, maybe Donald Trump, I don't know the whole fact, the record on the Trump University case. He did agree to $25 million settlement there. You know, the laws, that fact shows that the laws indeed are strict. Now, why haven't New York laws been applied to the Clinton Foundation? And I think
this is the question that was a holdover from yesterday. Trump also finds himself in a very precarious position, does he not? Because he had problems with his foundation using foundation money allegedly for purchase personal items and a piece of artwork for $10,000 and so forth. But nowhere does his transgression, if you will, compare to the monstrosity of the Clinton Foundation and the hundreds and billions of dollars that were funneled through it and still remain accounted for. Would you expect that this would be one of the problems that may hinder a prosecution of the Clintons and the Clinton Foundation under Trump administration, even though the head of the FBI is a holdover from the Obama administration? That's the first question. And the second, do you think that when we talk about this kind of activity, the prosecutions weren't limited to the United States? We had foreign governments now demanding answers. And have any of the foreign governments that had donated hundreds of millions of dollars to the Clinton Foundation under the guise that they were helping the foundation continue its, quote, good work all over the world, have there been legal actions taken to recoup their money?
Well, so in the first question, I think that the Trump team is going to actually administer justice blindly. You know, I think that there are ongoing investigations. We have been told by numerous different sources claim that there are ongoing IRS, FBI, and other investigations. Those will wend their merry way. I would have guessed, or I guess, that under the Barack Obama administration, it's possible, there have been reports, that the FBI was given more limited scope than they may get under a Trump administration to really exercise subpoena power, convene grand juries, and, ask questions of witnesses in ways that, you're going to get the answers as opposed to doing it in a more guarded fashion. So I think within the U.S., at federal level, it'll take time. I mean, Trump doesn't even have his cabinet, let alone his under-cabinet pick, in place yet. And this is a very complex mess. There's a lot of things going on, not simply with the Clinton Foundation. So it's going to take weeks and months, I think, to move along. But I hope and trust that the wheels of justice, actually scales of justice, will in fact be blind here. Whether you're a billionaire or a pauper, whether you're politically connected or not, I think it matters that rise to the level that this does of impugning the good name and reputation of all the many charities, American and other charities, that operate around the world. I would have thought that this is a massive issue, and we need to expose it, find out how far this cancer has spread. It is likely that it is not simply a Democrat issue. It's probably a Republican issue, and it's an independent issue, and it's an area where there are over a million charities, and I think the regulation apparatus in the U.S. is not equipped really to the task. It depends on the false assumption that fraudsters won't choose to go after charities, and I think the evidence suggests exactly the opposite. So on the first question, I think that and hope and trust that the federal government and then at least one of the states, I fail to understand what Arkansas is doing, not going after this, because this is a real blemish on Arkansas that I love to see. We've tried to get the forms that the Clinton Foundation was supposed to file with the Arkansas Department of Finance to get the right to be a charity and exempt from state corporation taxes in Arkansas, and I haven't seen them. I can't get them. Anyone out there who's listening, if you can find them, please send them to me. But you know, I'm hoping that a number of these states inside the U.S. will start looking at this. Yesterday, I was in communication with the Secretary of State's office in Maryland. There's this huge mystery in Maryland in 2010 where the Clinton Foundation claims in their form filed in 2011 and in the amended form in 2015 that their largest grant of $37.6 million in cash went to the Clinton Bush Haiti Fund in 2010. There's only one problem with their claim. In both of these filings, both submitted under penalties of federal penalties of perjury, their tax forms, that it went to a post office box in Maryland. And there is no record of the Clinton Bush Haiti Fund that I see having a post office box address in Maryland. So what exactly happened there? And why would you repeat that mistake twice? Why would you invent a four-digit number for the post office box? What's going on there? Because the Clinton Bush Haiti Fund's office was supposedly in Washington, D.C., and it files a form in New York under penalties of state perjury claiming that they have only one office, and the office is in Washington, D.C. So why would the parent company send $37.6 million to a post office box? And it gets more interesting. There's a second claim made on the Clinton Foundation filings, both the original one for 2010, the amended one in 2015, that they sent $4 million worth of goods and items down to Haiti, non-cash contributions. The Haiti fund claims it only received $1 million. So what happened to the other $3 million? And why would an accountant, an independent accountant, I think it's Titus firm, Mitchell and Titus or something like that, why would they sign off on an audit that says it's only $1 million when the Clinton Foundation parent is claiming it's $4 million? And then how does Bill Clinton get off saying in press releases that he created something called the Clinton Foundation Haiti Fund and that it raised $16.4 million for more than 40,000 individual donors, and that he raised this money using the Internet and the phone from New York? How does he do that? There is no such fund. No legal entity that I've found called the Clinton Foundation Haiti Fund. And he's got it on the annual report for 2009, the annual report for 2010, which is a glossy marketing brochure that you can see on the site that is, you know, it's not required. It's just a puff piece. But they make the claim twice. They make it on their 990, their annual report to the IRS for 2010. Extensive verbiage online about all this fund. You know, where did that $16.4 million really go, and under what authority did they have to claim they could raise that money? I mean, when they created the Clinton-Bush-Haiti Fund, Bill has never disclosed his true involvement with the American India Foundation and what actually happened in 2001 after the earthquake to all the money they supposedly raised. He's never made proper disclosure of what happened with the tsunami fund in league with UNICEF in 2005 or the Bush-Clinton-Katrina fund. There are all kinds of problems with that. He was never authorized to do international or domestic disaster relief in the guise of the William Clinton Foundation. And he wasn't an officer back when he was doing all this stuff. So on what basis was he raising the money? In New York, when you raise more than, I think it's $25,000 for a charity, and I'm doing this from memory now, I may be slightly off, you become a professional fundraiser. And professional fundraisers have to register. And they have to register, when they register, they have to explain any defects they may have in their record, which would include losing your law license for lying under oath. You know, that's when you're raising money for something, you're making representations about the state of the charity. And our authorities generally care about whether or not you have a record of lying. And, you know, it would seem that Mr. Clinton has quite a record of lying.
Well, so does Hillary. I mean, it's a family trait, it seems. What is happening to the overseas investigations?
Well, there I'm actually quite heartened. I think what happened was the punditry, the international punditry, especially the European chapter of the international punditry, I think is still trying to understand what may have happened on November 8th. And I believe that the way this might have worked is that the foreign governments realized that they had been defrauded. There's evidence that the French government realized that back in 2010. But what can you do? You know, if you think that Hillary Clinton's going to be the next president of the United States, are you really going to take on the Clinton II, you know, to go after them for this issue if she's president of the United States? I think the answer is you wouldn't.
Instead, how much money came from these foreign governments ostensibly to support the, quote, good works of the Clinton Foundation?
Well, you see, the simple fact is we don't know. I mean, under New York law, there's a strict requirement starting in, I think, 2004 to disclose every single grant made by a government to a foundation. Not you know, Australia, $16 million, but each grant, what was it for, the amount? And what office? You know, what office sent the money to what branch of the foundation? They're in violation of that law. And that, you know, that law is a tool that ordinarily would help the regulators figure out, you know, exactly what was going on here. The reason for this rule is that foreign governments are not, in theory, allowed to meddle in U.S. elections. And everybody's in high dudgeon about here, maybe properly, about whether the Russians were involved meddling in our election. This is a feature of the law that can be useful to track this kind of stuff down, because sometimes governments are strictly prohibited from meddling in elections, but they can get around that by making contributions to charities that are operated by politically influential figures like the Clintons. So here's a New York law. Here's Chuck Schumer, you know, Mr. Minority Leader, Mr. Big Mouth, standing up in the inauguration, talking endlessly. And meanwhile, the apparatus in New York is, I think, been gamed. It's been turned off. You know, it goes after enemies of the Democrats, and it doesn't do its job. And as in consequence, multiple governments, and I think the real number, Patrice, is more like billions or maybe even tens of billions of dollars when you count sums that government sent towards the interim Haiti recovery fund where Bill supposedly was co-chairman, towards the tsunami operation, towards the global fund where his ally Rajat Gupta was running that. You start looking at all these things, where it's UNICEF, UNAIDS, WHO, et cetera, and you're talking about tens of billions of contributions that go into these cesspools, never to be accounted for properly by real accounts, empowered to find out the truth. And therein creates the opportunity for the political class, often who doesn't have real wealth, to avail themselves of tidy retirement packages that are completely out of view of we the people. And that has to change. And I think Donald Trump and his people, I know some of the people in the Trump administration personally, and they care about this. And they really do care that charities be fairly administered and that the American, the vital American not-for-profit sector, which is gigantic. I mean, on its own, the not-for-profit sector in the United States is bigger than most countries in the world. A lot of really wonderful people, some pursuing, you know, projects I don't approve of, but it's not my issue. If they want to volunteer their time and do something that truly is charitable, go for it. And, you know, it's a wonderful tradition in America. It goes way, way back. It's, you know, it unites us all, frankly. A lot of good works have been done by American charities around the world. And, you know, what's going on here, thank you for helping to expose this, I think it needs to be taken to a new level. I think there are lots of these frauds. It's not simply the Clinton Foundation. I believe there are all sorts of things that sound good on paper, but then when you look into them, are just frauds.
Well, I know you're not a lawyer. You are a numbers guy, and you study numbers, and you tell us that numbers tell you stories. You've been studying this now for about 2 years, chasing down every possible piece of paper you could find about the Clintons and their financial reports and what they were supposed to do to justify the solicitation of funds and, of course, the disbursement of funds for all these grand projects. We've talked about the absurdity, the criminal absurdity of many of these projects that really don't do nearly anything that they say that the projects were designed to do. In your very microscopic study of these numbers, What do you see as the smoking gun here with the Clinton Foundation?
Well, I'd say the biggest affront, frankly, to humanity of everything they're doing here is the supposed fight against HIV/AIDS. Now, when I think HIV/AIDS remains a scourge. It still afflicts tens of millions of people around the world, and we should do what we can as quickly as we can, not simply to forestall the onset of AIDS, but ideally to find a way to cure it. And, when you say to a sophisticated person, you have a cure for AIDS, that's a medical miracle, frankly. People have been working for a long time. No one's cured it yet. What they've been able to do is prevent the onset of the final stages of the disease, the transfer from when HIV goes into full-blown AIDS. You could stall that for many, many years, as Magic Johnson can attest. But, what the Clintons have done here is, they got together with Ira Magaziner, according to the Joe Connison book, early in 2002, just when they were having great difficulty raising money because there was, as we now know, an FBI investigation, an active FBI investigation into the Rich Pardon. There were grand juries about to be convened. There were subpoenas flying everywhere. It was tough to raise money for a project to build a library. So Ira comes on the scene and what can we do? What sounds good? And they hit on this idea of fighting HIV/AIDS. Well, that would have been fine if in whatever they changed course, if they'd gone to the IRS and said, look, you approved us for the purpose of building this library. We haven't even broken ground yet, but we've decided now we want to fight HIV/AIDS internationally. Here's the team. Here's the way we're going to do it. Here's how we're going to control these international operations. This is why we're qualified to do it. You go through that exercise. They could have got validly authorized, but they chose not to do that. And then they began this process of asserting they were doing this in a way that you can't really check. They based the operation in Ira's offices of his consulting firm, a for-profit operation. Well, how are those costs supposedly shared? In Connison's book, it claims that Magaziner invested in this venture, $1 million. How do you invest in a charity? What does that mean? And that he got David Sainsbury, the famous English magnate, to put, I think, $300,000 or so into it. How do you invest in a charity? You can't invest in a charity. You donate to a charity. Well, how do you do that if it hasn't actually been created? Did he invest in the parent company? Did he invest in a side venture? What did he actually invest in? They claim that they began operations for this thing in the Bahamas. You can't do that. You have to control an American charity from the U.S. base. How does somebody, Bill Clinton, not an officer or director of a charity, control something in the Bahamas that doesn't legally exist? You can't do that. And how do you then, their favorite term of art, I hate this term, I'm never going to get involved in a memorandum of understanding. It's a worthless junk piece of document. But that's where they start signing all over the world, Mozambique, you name it, different countries, different companies, different trade associations, different collections of nations, PanCap, I think the Pan-Caribbean something or other partnership. They do a joint venture with, MOU with them. They do an MOU across Africa and India and China and Ukraine and everywhere. They're all meaningless, completely meaningless documents. Then they enter into a memorandum of understanding with this drug manufacturer, Ranbaxy. Ranbaxy brags about it on their timeline in their annual report for the year that ends March 31st, 2004. They claim that they entered into the MOU in 2003. There are only a few problems with this MOU. The first is that the Clinton Foundation, according to the MOU, its mission is to promote the sale of Ranbaxy drugs. Well, that's not very charitable. And back in 2003, Ranbaxy was having a devil of a time cracking the U.S. market in the scale they needed. So, this agreement with Bill Clinton helped them probably to do that. We learned later that some 10 months after the agreement was signed in October 2003, by August 2004, we learned, thanks to a legal action, that Ranbaxy was in dire straits in August of 2004. I think it was the South African government had been alerted, called them to task by the WHO that the Ranbaxy drugs had been, you know, in quotes, approved on false tests. They didn't actually have internal tests that prove the effectiveness of these drugs and the ingredients going into these drugs. And then a subsequent investigation revealed that prior to August 2004, Ranbaxy had not tested legally any of its drugs. So why did Bill Clinton and Ira Magaziner sign an agreement cause an agreement to be signed obligating the Clinton Foundation to promote the sale of drugs that are manufactured by a horrible company? Why did they do that, and why is that charitable? And what was the basis of that agreement? Well, none of this is disclosed.
And the drugs were found also to be possibly adulterated drugs.
Right. And you know, therein lies the rub, you know, with the branded pharma companies. I've got my own issues with branded pharmaceutical companies. But, you know, the classic debate between the branded and the generics, the branded guys say, you know, the reason you're paying such high prices is we assure the quality. And the generics guys say, no, that's rubbish. You know, we could do this with a fraction of the branded cost or just excess profits. There's an element of truth to both camps. But in this case, this proves what the branded people were saying back then. I mean, these generic companies, Ranbaxy was, I think, the largest in the world, has now been proven through a process with our own federal authorities that culminated in a $500 million fine, I believe, by settlement or economic penalty in the May of 2013. And even after Ranbaxy was fined in May of 2013, they were punished again. I mean, this is just a company that's rampantly corrupt and operating way outside the law. So, you know, why did a former president of the United States and this other Rhodes scholar, Ira Magaziner, go anywhere near Ranbaxy? You know, why do they still stand up for Ranbaxy? And how many other diabolical companies have fed junk through the Clinton Foundation into the veins, literally into the veins and hearts of these
On one level, I could see that this would be of interest in, you know, prosecuting from a point of view of, you know, this is a rogue philanthropic organization. But this is organized crime. This is organized crime on an extraordinarily expansive level. And raking in billions of dollars, utilizing the political currency of a former president of the United States, and she was doing this while she was Secretary of State as well, and even afterwards going into her campaign for the presidency. So this is huge crime, and you mentioned yesterday that if you were to add up the inurements that accrued to the major players involved, you're possibly looking at trillions of dollars. And yet, there has been no movement. We haven't seen, maybe it's because the case is this complex, I don't know. But it seems to me that something should have happened by now to signal a move here on the Clinton Foundation, never mind the fact that the Clinton Global Initiative decides to shut down in April. But the tentacles of the foundation still remain intact, and they're still doing business.
Yeah, it's I think, though, you know, we are where we are. What's today? The 24th, is it?
Fifth. Yes.
And, you know, we're not even through Trump's first week. I think countries around the world are trying to figure out what Trump's all about. Which way is he going to jump? And, you know, I would guess that or I believe that many governments have been studying this for a while and have been, you know, waiting to see who was going to win. Now they know. And I think actually where before the question was, you know, do we want to open this can of worms? Now I think given the climate of populist outrage over government excess and overreach, I really think the shoe's on the other foot. You know, in France, we have a big election, I think in April. And, you know, the French government is indirectly one of the largest government contributors to the Clinton Foundation, in that they have contributed, I think, more than 60% of the many billions of dollars that have gone into UNITAID came from France, and then UNITAID has given the Clinton Foundation approximately $650 million to its illegally organized HIV/AIDS operation. So that's call it $350, $360 million or so that the French government has funneled through Switzerland into this Clinton Foundation. Now, why are the people of France willing to just sit there and take it? You know, why don't they say, look, we want our money back? I mean, why are we doing this? And then why are the people of Great Britain, who I think starting in around 2007 signed up to give UNITAID £1 billion? Now, a pound doesn't get you as much as it used to get you, but that's a lot. That's some serious coin. Why is that money going through UNITAID into the Clinton Foundation? I think, you know, country, Canada, you know, why starting in 2003, according to numerous reports, why did lots of money go from Canada into an organization that didn't exist? And who looked the other way? I mean, you know, people generally do due diligence. Where's the record of that? Show us the record in Canada and in Norway and in Sweden and the UK and in Australia. Show us the record, please, of who did the work to study this. What did they actually find? Because I think they must have used, no insult to Mr. Magoo, but I think they must have used Mr. Magoo here. And I think he's a wonderful cartoon character, but not terribly good at charity due diligence. So, you know, what's going on here? And, you know, how can you have meeting after meeting and audit report after audit report signing off on this mess? How can you have state regulators, all our states? How can you have really smart people like Bill Gates and his wife, Warren Buffett, and the various people on the board of the Rockefeller Foundation and the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, and, you know, gone and on and on? How does Elton John, maybe Elton John's too busy playing concerts, but how does he allow his UK and US foundation to put money into a fraud? How does Fred Eichner out there in Chicago, who's a shrewd operator, how does he put $25 million into this? How does the Children's Investment Fund Foundation in the UK and in the US, their twin foundations, how do they put money in here? Why does Mike Bloomberg allow his philanthropy to get involved with a charity that doesn't exist, the Clinton Climate Change Initiative? I mean, it's never been formed validly. How does he lend his good name? And he knows charities, and he certainly knows New York. These are some big questions that I think people deserve answers.
Well, you've done a great deal in helping to provide answers. I remind the audience that we have the privilege of talking to the man who blew the whistle on Wall Street and its over valuation of stock, bringing down the wrath of Ortel on companies like AIG and General Electric and General Motors. And it was because of the same diligence that he invested in looking at their numbers, was he able to determine that massive fraud was occurring on Wall Street. So, Charles, thanks again for this chapter. It helps us get closer to an understanding of where this case possibly might be going. But I know you are also working on uncovering more details, and we'll be ready to receive them when you give the signal. Thanks for joining us today.
Thank you, Yudri.
Thank you. Well, a couple of things I want to let you know. To listen to this program live, you can call 712-775-6850. That's 712-775-6850. You can pass the number along to people who might not be able to have access during the day, but they do have access via their phones, so they could listen on the phone with that number. And if you call 701-719-9977, you can listen to the last five editions of Lead Stories. So that is one way that we're trying to help the folks have access, so you don't have to wait till the evening or the night to go to the podcast. You can listen live with these numbers. Again, to listen live, 712 775-6850, and to listen to the last five shows, 701-719-9977. Thank you so much for joining me today. I hope the program helped us all understand the connections of things. We have a new administration, supposedly very, very on point about doing the right thing. Let's see, because it also has some problems. We'll be following this story, of course, and we'll be back tomorrow doing some more talking about what's developing in Washington, D.C., but most importantly, remember, this is what we're focusing on, not only is what's going on in D.C., but what's going on with us, getting ready to challenge what's going on in D.C. Thanks so much for listening. A pleasure and a great privilege to be in your company. Stay tuned. Coming up next, NDC Savings Club, and you can reach me at leadstories@gmail.com. See you tomorrow. Bye-bye.